Welcome to part 3 of our Sweden series. As discussed in the last episode, I've now had Sweden's Civil Defence Booklet from 1961, If War Comes, translated for me by two very kind podcast listeners, Jason and David. So thank you to you both. I also got an email to my Patreon a few days ago from Patrick, who has very generously found and translated the Danish Nuclear Civil Defence Booklet for me. So of course, we will look at the Danish booklet at a later date. In the meantime, I've uploaded the weird, creepy green illustrations from the Danish booklet to my Patreon page, and the Swedish one is already there. So if you're a patron, you can jump online and have a look at both of them. So today we're looking at half of the Swedish booklet. I had assumed we would do the whole booklet in one podcast episode, but by the time I had got to the halfway point of the booklet, I'd saw that my script had reached 11 pages on Word, and normally my podcast scripts get to about 5 pages, so I don't want it to be a horrendously long podcast. I like to get them normally about 20-25 minutes, so we will look at the first half in this episode and the second half next week. So we'll walk through the Swedish booklet and we will compare it, where applicable, to British civil defence leaflets. The most infamous, of course, is Protect and Survive. I find that also the most interesting, but it's probably not fair or sensible to compare If War Comes with Protect and Survive, as they are both from different eras. This Swedish leaflet is from the 60s, and of course Protect and Survive is from the 80s. So instead, we will draw comparisons where applicable with a British leaflet from the same decade, advising the householder on protection against nuclear attack, which was issued in 1963. Now, before we even turn to the content of the Swedish booklet, there is one huge difference between the Swedish one and the British one. Sweden actually distributed their booklets to the population. Britain didn't. Now, you're probably familiar with the fuss kicked up in Britain in the early 80s about the government's refusal to distribute en masse Protect and Survive. It was known that the government had prepared a civil defence booklet, but where was it? Why were they keeping it hidden? Is it because the truth is so harrowing? The situation so hopeless? Is it because they fear being mocked? They dread causing panic? They don't want to aggravate the Soviets? As I mentioned in the Protect and Survive chapter of my book, the truth was actually very humdrum. There was no great secret, no big conspiracy. The intention was, simply, that Protect and Survive would be released to the public, both as a booklet, in newspapers, and as a series of short films, when it was deemed that nuclear war was imminent. And yet, the government were criticised for withholding it. The government must have been shrugging their shoulders at all these complaints, saying, "The time of horror and apocalypse simply hasn't arrived yet. I thought you lot would be pleased about that." And instead we moaned. And what about the British Civil Defence Booklet from 63, advising the householder? That's the one we're going to compare today to the Swedish booklet. Was that one released to the public? No, but for different reasons. Advising the householder was never meant as a booklet to be read by every household in the country. It was never going to be delivered to every door. Instead, it was intended to be given to the Civil Defence Corps, the fire brigades, police, local councils, etc. And it was meant as a kind of training manual for them. As the title suggests, it was about how they would advise the householder on what to do to prepare their home for nuclear attack. But compare both of those British approaches to Sweden's. Sweden sent the booklet out to every household and made sure it was available printed in the back of the phone book, just in case you'd lost your copy, of course. So it was completely accessible, readily available, and free. So let's see what the booklet said. A reminder that we're looking here at the 1961 version. They had a version issued during the Second World War, and of course, they have sent out an updated version recently, following the surge in tensions with Russia. But our interest, of course, is in the Cold War advice, the nuclear stuff. So we go back to the 1961 edition. The booklet is called, I'm sorry for my pronunciation if I get anything wrong here, Sweden. The booklet is called Om Kriget Kommer, which means If the War Comes. And the illustration on the front page looks like dark, gathering storm clouds. The text on the back cover, translated for me of course by my two kind patrons, says simply, if the war comes, the advice and instructions in this booklet will be decisive for your chances of survival. Keep this booklet in a safe place. One day you may need it. The booklet is clearly labelled on the front page as Guidance for Swedish Citizens. So, unlike the British booklet of the same era, this one is not designed to be fed to you through the filter of your local civil defence worker or policeman or politician. This is speaking directly to the population. Inside, it starts with a message to the people of Sweden, which I'll read to you. To the citizens of Sweden, Sweden wants peace. It is our hope that a détente between the great powers is possible and that world peace can be preserved. Unfortunately, for as long as international tensions persist, there is a threat to peace. Our country must therefore be prepared for the worst that can happen, that war will come. The aim of our country's defence is to preserve our freedom and independence. The people of Sweden are united in their determination to protect their country's freedom and independence. Hence, every armed attack on our freedom must be countered with determined resistance. Total war requires total defence. Every citizen must be prepared to contribute to the utmost to this total defence. In the armed forces, civil defence, war production, public supply, healthcare, and in their own homes. Everyone must know how to protect themselves against the dangers that a modern war will entail and realise how essential it is to remain calm in critical situations. Citizens of Sweden are therefore asked to read the contents of this booklet carefully. You need to think about how you and your family will act if the war comes. Stockholm Palace, May 1961. The message is signed by two people, King Carl Gustaf and Prime Minister Tage Erlander. Now that is something you'd never see in a Cold War civil defence booklet from Britain. It's well known that our monarch doesn't get involved in politics. They are supposed to be seen as elegantly aloof, floating above all that dirty work, and doing nothing so ordinary as taking sides in a debate. Certainly, Queen Elizabeth never put her name to either of Britain's two nuclear civil defence booklets. But then you might ask, why should civil defence be a political issue on which you take sides? Is it not just common sense, as the recruitment slogan went in Britain? Civil defence is common sense. So maybe there was no question of the Swedish monarch taking sides when he put his name to this booklet. This is, after all, simply a booklet giving advice for the population on what to do if war comes. How could anyone object to that? But in Britain, as we know, civil defence was always tormented and twisted into becoming a red-hot political issue. And so no monarch or prime minister added their signature to Britain's booklets. Because doing so would mean that you were taking sides. And so febrile was Britain's politics, especially in the 1980s, that if, for example, Margaret Thatcher had put her signature to protect and survive, then some people would probably rather die than adopt the booklet and take its advice. Growing up in 1980s Glasgow, I remember it well, how strong was a lot of the feeling against Margaret Thatcher. Even when she died, there were people, which I think is appalling, dancing in George Square in celebration. So yes, if she had personally signed Protect and Survive and endorsed it, I think some people would have said, yeah, I would rather vanish in the nuclear flash than do anything she recommends. That's British politics for you, or at least that's how I remember it from the 80s. So I assume then that politics in Sweden was more mature, or at least calmer, than it was here. And maybe, to be fair to us in Britain, maybe civil defence wasn't such a hot topic in Sweden, because they, of course, were not, and are not, a nuclear power. Because in Britain, any civil defence advice from the government always invited accusations from opponents that, well, we wouldn't need this advice if our own nuclear weapons didn't make us a target in the first place. You couldn't level any kind of accusation like that against the Swedish government. If we look at the wording of the message from the King and the Prime Minister, we see it's immediately obvious. This is a country not in possession of nuclear weapons, and who don't expect to be directly attacked with such weapons. It was always an option, of course, but that wasn't the main consideration as it was in Britain. Firstly, it warns the reader of armed attack, whereas our booklet, the one from 1963, doesn't mince words and specifically says there is a risk of nuclear attack. The Swedish booklet also says the aim of our country's defence is to preserve our freedom and independence. Whereas the British stance was always that the aim of our defence, i.e. our nuclear weapons, is to deter an attack. Or, to quote directly from the short intro in Advising the Householder, the primary purpose of the government's defence policy is to prevent war. And in the rest of the intro, we find no positive words that the Swedes use in theirs, like peace, freedom, and independence. So maybe that's one of the prices you pay for being a nuclear power, and therefore a nuclear target. Focus first on deterring the nuclear attack, and then you can indulge in the nice things like peace and freedom. Turning to page 2, the heading here is Total War, Total Defence. Swedes are warned of the various ways they may be attacked in a coming war, from the sinking of merchant ships, an invasion, the bombing of civilian and military targets, plus factories, railway junctions, and power plants. There may also be the malicious spreading of infectious diseases, and maybe a surge in sabotage, espionage, and the spreading of damaging rumours and propaganda. So we see that the Swedish are presented here with a, to use a brilliant Swedish word, a smorgasbord of war horrors. You don't get that in the British booklet, which focuses simply on one, the nuclear attack, how to protect your home against its blast, its heat, and its fallout. This is obviously because Britain had more reason to believe it would be nuked. And so when you have that inconvenience to deal with, the disruption of merchant shipping or the spreading of rumours might seem a bit like a triviality. Britain was forced to put all its attention on the nuclear attack. You have to survive that, everything else will have to wait. But Sweden could turn its attention to other aspects of war. The Swedish booklet then makes a morale-boosting statement. It says, Sweden wants to defend itself. Can defend itself and shall defend itself. Resistance shall be made constantly and in all situations. It depends on you, your effort, your determination, your will to survive. We never give up. Any message stating that resistance should cease is false. Page 4 deals with another aspect which is missing from Britain's booklets. What will happen to the government if war comes? Of course, advising the householder and, later, Protect and Survive, were all about the individual and his home. They never mentioned what would happen to those in charge. And so I think it's brave of Sweden to approach the subject, because in Britain, certainly, this always tended to rake up resentment. Something along the lines of, well, the politicians will have access to bunkers, but there's nothing for the little guy. So arrangements for central government in Britain were always cloaked in secrecy. But the Swedish booklet says, with what I think is admirable honesty, that the government cannot remain in Stockholm during the war. The king, government, parliament and authorities will move from the capital to less vulnerable places. This move is not to escape the conflict, even if the hostile propaganda will claim this. In other words, we are not running away, we are just trying to go somewhere where we can still function and get the job done. So there's two main points there. One, they are being brave enough to admit that they won't be staying in the capital under bombardment, and surely this might have opened them up to accusations of cowardice, of running away, of leaving the Stockholm civilians to face the worst on their own. Certainly in the 60s, the same decade that the Swedish booklet was published, this is what happened in Britain. We have talked before about the Spies for Peace scandal. In 1963, an anonymous group of activists broke into the secret government bunker at Warren Row in Berkshire. And that was designed to act as a regional seat of government if nuclear war had come. The activists took photographs and photocopied documents and maps, and then sent all the juicy info to the media, to peace groups, to politicians. And they made it plain that these bunkers intended to protect, quote, a chosen few. Well, the rest of us would be left without any protection. But then, maybe the Swedish authorities could afford to be brave in admitting they would leave Stockholm, because they weren't vulnerable, as the British authorities were, to accusations that they were leaving their population unprotected. Because Sweden did provide public shelters in case of nuclear war. And we will look at that in the coming weeks. So it seems to me the Swedish government had more leeway to be honest and to talk about more subjects, because they weren't hampered, as the British government were, by accusations from left-wingers, people who opposed nuclear weapons, people who were angry at the lack of provision of public shelters. Yep, the Swedish government seems to have more room for manoeuvre here, as I can see it. The second thing to note in this section is that the Swedes stress that the government will have left Stockholm so that they can continue to function. They are not running away. And they stress, even if the hostile propaganda will claim this is so. So again, they are warning the population to be wary of rumour, gossip and propaganda in wartime or in the approach of war, as it could be coming from, of course, a hostile, malicious or foreign source. Now this, again, is something the British booklets don't concern themselves with. Probably because if it did happen, war, we would be a radioactive wasteland. So there would be no point sending Russian agents in to spread rumours. But Sweden might still expect to be a functioning society, even after war. So there is something to be gained for the foreign agent and his disinformation and propaganda. Sweden is obviously physically closer to the Soviet Union than we are, or we were. So it'd be far easier to slip agents and spies and materials into the country. The next page describes the air raid warnings in Sweden. There are three. Again, this differs from Britain's. We had two different uses of the siren. One, the infamous rising and falling wail to announce an incoming attack. And the other, where the siren is sounded at one steady note to announce the all clear. There would also be a fallout warning, which would be sounded by bangs made by exploding maroons, banging a gong, or blasting a whistle. But Sweden, as we know, was not necessarily expecting a nuclear attack. As we discussed earlier, they presented their population with a smorgasbord of options. There were lots of different types of attack anticipated in Sweden. Could be tanks rolling across the border, could be an air raid, could be attacks on shipping. So there's no need for a specific fallout warning. Instead, Sweden had what they called a preparedness alert. And that would sound when they judge that attack is imminent. It's not that they have spotted missiles being launched from the Soviet Union and you've got 4 minutes left. It's not that kind of siren. It's a preparedness alert saying war is imminent, threat is imminent, start getting ready. The preparedness alert would be a 30-second signal, followed by a 15-second pause, then the 30-second signal again, with that cycle repeated for 5 minutes. This means get ready, prepare for an incoming attack. It means get indoors, listen to the radio for further information on what to do. Then, when the attack had been launched, would come the air attack warning. That means, of course, incoming missiles or bombers have been spotted. Then, later, you would get the all clear. A long signal sounded for 30 seconds. So they differ from us in having three different types of siren, or siren sound. Another interesting aspect of Sweden's alert system, which differs from Britain's, is that the air attack warning would be sounded by sirens, obviously outside on top of buildings, but also, according to this booklet, across the telephone system. One of my patrons translates this part as saying that the signal will be delivered via flat, rapid tones over the phone. So that would be a good way of ensuring alert coverage for those who are out in the country, out of earshot of the big urban sirens. Although a listener from Sweden called Peter messaged me on Facebook last night and confirmed for me, thank you Peter, that the phones wouldn't ring across the whole country. They would only ring in the target area. We know Britain's method of alerting such people, those living out in the country, was to give a handheld siren and install a warning point with people like country pub landlords, vicars or doctors out in the countryside, and to ask that when their personal warning point at home or in the pub starts to sound, they grab their handheld siren and run outside and start winding it by hand. And that's how you would alert people in the local village. But in Sweden, quite sensibly, they could also deliver the sound across telephones. The Swedish siren system is commonly known then and now as Hesa Fredrik, and it's been in place since 1931. Hesa Fredrik translates as Horse Fredrik, and it was given that nickname after the journalist Oscar Fredrik Rydqvist, who wrote in the 30s, when the system was installed, that the harsh tone sounded like him when he had a cold. So here is the sound. Or at least this is a modern sound from YouTube. I don't know if it still sounded that way back in the 30s. I assume it did, after all our sirens were the same in the Cold War as they were in the Second World War. I think it sounds more like a ship's horn. Either way, it doesn't sound terrifying to me, like the rising and falling wail of Britain's siren, which I think is like a banshee howl. But then maybe everyone is primed to fear their own country's siren. You've learned that that is what danger sounds like in your own country. So that is Hesa Fredrik. That is Horse Fredrik. There are currently 4,600 Hesa Fredrik sirens in Sweden. And they are regularly tested. Siren tests occur at 3 o'clock on the first Monday of March, June, September and December, with the exception of public holidays. Turning to page 7, we see the first mention of nuclear weapons in the booklet. The British one, of course, mentions it, well, in its very title, advising the householder on protection against nuclear attack. But we have to wait to page 7 to get the first mention of nuclear weapons in the Swedish booklet, the Swedish term for atomic weapons being atomvapen. So the first mention here of atomic weapons comes linked to the topic of evacuation, saying that we will need to evacuate our cities if there is a risk of nuclear attack. Now, that makes sense in Sweden, especially the Sweden of 1961, whose population was approximately 7.5 million, and whose population density was a nicely spacious 19 people per square kilometre. Compare that to crowded Britain, who had a population of 53 million at the same time, and whose density was a huge 222 per square kilometre. Evacuation would have been nightmarish for us, and also quite futile, as we've discussed plenty of times before. But Sweden, with far more space, far less people, and which wasn't expecting to be nuked into eternity with thermonuclear bombs and all the fallout that would bring, well, evacuation made sense for them. If there is, maybe in the worst case scenario, going to be an atomvapen or two on Stockholm or a port, then by all means, try to get the civilians out into the countryside. There is plenty of space. Remember, of course, Sweden is also geographically much bigger than the UK. 450,000 square kilometres to our 243,000. So they have more space, less people, less targets, and less reason to think that they would become a nuclear target in the first place. Evacuation would have made sense. The booklet does warn, however, that evacuation would bring problems of its own. Sure, it might have saved a great number of Swedes from nuclear attack, but it would cause lots of social and economic upheaval. If we think back to the war game, again from the same era, the 60s, we see a hint of the social upheaval caused when local homeowners in the film are not too happy to be told they need to take in evacuees from the city. One woman even asks the civil defence workers, with obvious anxiety, are they coloured? Now, I don't think there would have been much racial tension if evacuation had happened in 1960s Sweden. I don't think they had the strong post-war immigration that Britain did. Britain, of course, famously had to call upon the Empire to help her out after the war with our great labour shortage. But even without racism, there would still be resentment and upset and tension at having to throw open your home. Being compelled, of course, it's not voluntary in the Cold War evacuation plans, being made to open your home to strangers. In my book's chapter on evacuation, I went back to the Second World War and the experience in Britain of little kids being evacuated to the countryside. It was, and mainly still is, portrayed as a joyous, happy thing with little urchins who grew up in the dirty streets of the East End, finally seeing the sun, finally breathing fresh air, finally tasting vegetables and fruit. But there was lots of hostility and resentment, especially when the kids were dirty, unwashed, lacked manners, lacked hygiene, or when babies or toddlers arrived and brought their mother with them. It might seem cute to take in a little toddler, but what if that wee toddler comes with an adult as well, one who knows the child better, knows how they like to be fed, knows how to get them off to sleep, leaving the lady of the house feeling frozen out in her own home. There was also cruelty, even if it was unintended. My book describes how trainloads of little kids would be ushered into the village hall, whilst the ladies came to choose one. You weren't allocated an evacuee at random. You could go in and have a look at them, have a sniff at them, and choose one who looked and smelled nice. Often the ladies might opt for the pretty little girls, and the farmers might choose strong-looking boys. Those children who were dirty, or crying, or, as I said, smelly and unwashed, would be left behind, with the civil defence workers at the end of the day having to trail door to door as it got dark, asking people to please accept these leftover children. They unwanted ones. And let's be honest, many of the children would, I'm sorry if it sounds cruel, but they would look unappealing to those who were shopping for a nice evacuee, because most of them had endured long train rides from the big cities, often journeys with hefty delays, as their trains would have to give up space to any troop trains, any military trains going by. Many of the trains didn't have toilets, meaning little kids would, of course, on a hugely long and stressful journey, wet or soil themselves. Some would be sick through nerves, tears, or travel sickness. Others from poor areas would have nits or lice or would be visibly dirty. Often those with lice would have had the problem tackled with their first visit to the school nurse in the autumn. But of course the war started in September, so many kids missed that appointment, which could have assured them of cream for their rashes and lotion for their nits. So they were turning up to be presented to their hosts in perhaps the worst possible state. But I digress. My point is that evacuation would surely, even in spacious Sweden, bring awful tensions and unpleasantness. And then obviously economic upheaval. Again, I mentioned in the book how if evacuation had been triggered in the Cold War in Britain, and if you triggered it too soon and war didn't erupt, then you've created chaos and you've dragged people away from their work, emptied the cities for nothing. And what if, and Matthew Grant mentions this in his book After the Bomb, your enemy could keep bringing relations to the brink of war in the hope that you would keep triggering evacuation, so they could economically ruin you just by threatening war. So no matter how spacious and wealthy and kind your country is, evacuation is always going to be difficult. Because I suppose it all boils down to the fact that, as individuals, we don't want to invite someone into the home who is full of lice and dirt and bad manners. The idealised or romanticised notion of sheltering an evacuee, taking in an innocent child, helping your country in its hour of need, being benevolent and gracious, well, that will quickly butt up against the dirt and the lice and the noise. It's the pious dream versus the nasty reality. If I can offer an example from my own childhood, there was a wee girl a few years below me in primary school whose mum had died. And it always seemed so Victorian, so cruel to me that a child could lose their mother at such a young age. It seemed like a thing from, you know, the old days. And so when my other gran gave me a sandwich bag filled with mini Mars bars, I don't know why she had such a thing, maybe it was the day after Halloween or something, I thought, with the pride and determination, I am going to go straight back to school and hand the whole bag to this wee girl. I will turn over every last one of my mini Mars bars to her. And I felt good and pious and warm. I'll be like a saint, I thought. Yeah, I was brought up as a Catholic at a Catholic school. So yes, I will be a saint. But when I walked up Kittriggs Avenue and got back to school, and when I entered the playground with my sandwich bag, reality hit me. Give the whole bag away. All of my mini Mars bars. Feelings of sainthood started to wilt. Maybe I could just give her a handful of the mini Mars bars. Maybe we could sit on the tree stump and share them out. Oh God, it's all getting too complicated. Trying to be a saint was too hard. So I kept the mini Mars bars. I kept all of them. Being saintly and good was a nice idea, but oh, the reality of it. And that's how I see evacuation. The next page in the leaflet is called Your Role in Total Defence. We discussed the Swedish concept of total defence in the last episode, so we won't go over it again. But the main point here is everyone in Sweden has a role to play if war comes. This is not something that you can leave to the soldiers. But for those who are required to don a uniform when war comes, those who will be called up, whether it's into the military or into civil defence forces. Sweden offers a nice, practical bit of help in making sure those people can quickly get to their muster station when the preparedness alert is sounded. The booklet says that your call-up papers could also be used as a travel ticket. Now, I like that detail. Practicality in the midst of the coming apocalypse. So if the war breaks out suddenly, and you find it's impossible to get to your designated muster station, the booklet says, well, you can't just say, oh, I tried, and then slink off home. No, you must, in that case, go somewhere else. If you can't get to your designated point, then you must go to the local police station or the local civil defence organisers. You must go somewhere of relevance. You can't just go home. The illustration in the booklet here shows hardy Swedish people making every effort to get to their designated locations when the siren sounds. We see one guy on a motorbike, others have jumped into cars, someone is trying to hitch a lift, and there's a wee man in the background on skis. Of course, many others will be required under total defence to take on a particular role in wartime. It's not all military or civil defence, of course. You might be required to take up a role in industry or communications or healthcare. And the illustration here shows us a nurse, a welder, a bus driver, and a traffic warden. So likewise, these people must also go to their designated wartime workplace. And then those who are already in essential occupations, like policemen, firemen, doctors, nurses, well, they must stay in their existing roles. So you're either being called up to the military or to civil defence. You're either being allocated an essential role in healthcare or industry or communications, or you're already in an important job and you're told to stay where you are, continue doing what you're already doing. But whatever happens and whatever megatonnage hits Stockholm, you all have your travel tickets, so there can be no excuses. This section ends with a heartwarming statement, something which is a million miles away from cold and impersonal civil defence booklets elsewhere. It says, in times of war, we must help each other more than usual. Everyone in their place, and to the best of their ability. Now, I know I said it wasn't fair to compare this 1960s Swedish booklet with Protect and Survive. So if you go back to the 1960s British booklet, Advising the Householder, we might not see heartwarming statements like that, but there is at least a suggestion that you offer shelter to anyone who is caught in the open when the siren sounds. And there's a further reminder, once you have seen to your own household, help any neighbour in need. We've talked before, and also in my book, of how that all evaporates by the time Protect and Survive comes out in the early 80s. Page 10 is entitled Bered Skapslarm, which my kind patrons who translated this for me tell me means preparedness alert. We've mentioned that briefly already, how Sweden had three different alerts. So this is worth looking at closely, as we had no such thing in Britain. You got one warning siren, the, as it was called popularly, 4-minute warning. The one which said, the missiles are on their way. This is it. But Sweden had different stages of alert. So what exactly was the preparedness alert? It would sound across the nation from the sirens on top of buildings when the government had decided that they had reached a state of emergency and an attack is surely coming. The closest thing to that in Britain would have been the government deciding that we had entered what they called the precautionary stage. And this is when civil defence preparations would be stepped up, but there would be no audible alarm or siren sounded to announce that we had entered that stage. You would just know that things were heating up thanks to news reports. And as we see in Threads, when young Michael is in the school playground and he sees a van pulling up and they start unloading blankets, That's obviously them preparing the school to be an emergency shelter, providing food or welfare to any survivors. So there'd be little signals like that, that things had stepped up a gear. But when Sweden entered this heightened stage, there would be a specific siren sound for it. As we mentioned previously, it would be a blast on the alarm for 30 seconds, then a 15-second pause, then 30-second blast again, and that sequence would repeat. The Beredskapslarm, the preparedness alert, seems slightly more urgent, slightly more advanced along the timeline than our precautionary stage. The Swedish alarm means, yes, we are in that final stage, but we also have reason to believe that it's all just about to kick off. So it's, if you imagine a timeline, it's further along the timeline than the precautionary stage, but we're not yet at the 4-minute warning. So the booklet says when you hear the preparedness alert, you must do several things. One, turn on the radio and await instructions. Two, darken your home. Three, be prepared to seek shelter quickly. Four, be prepared to evacuate. Five, if you have orders to join the military or civil defence in the event of war, go now to your muster point. Now those points are all quite self-explanatory, but point number two is of special interest. That is, darken your home. Now that's what we did in Britain, of course, during the Second World War, in the blackout. And it was so, as you know, we could hide the existence of urban areas from the Luftwaffe. But you don't need to bother with blackout in the age of the missile, as it doesn't care whether your lights are on or off. It doesn't need to be guided by the lights of a city. So this is a reminder to us that Sweden might not necessarily be expecting a nuclear attack delivered by missile. It could be merely a conventional bombing attack delivered by plane. In which case, yes, we're back to the good old blackouts. So a reminder again, there are plenty of them in this booklet, that Sweden was not expecting the same attack we would have been preparing for in Britain, i.e. nuclear holocaust. They had lots of, you could call them lesser options that they were expecting. Not that, of course, a conventional bombing attack wouldn't be horrific. We all know that. We look at Coventry, look at Dresden, look at Tokyo. All I'm saying is there were lots of other wartime attack options below a nuclear attack, and Sweden had to be on guard for all of them. Whereas in Britain, we were mainly about preparing for the big one. The booklet also politely asks that after hearing the preparedness alert, you do not use the phone for the next few hours, as authorities will need use of the phone lines. The Swedish government must have trusted their people to act responsibly and not hog the phone lines. Not so in Britain, where we know that our phone lines would immediately be dead to civilian use, thanks to what was called the Telephone Preference Scheme. I first learned of this in Duncan Campbell's book Warplan UK. This scheme allocated a category to every single phone line in Britain. You were either category 1, 2 or 3. The vast majority were category 3, and this meant those lines would be cut off. They could still receive incoming calls, but you would not be able to call out. You can't phone your relatives in a panic. You can't, in other words, hog the phone lines. Category 1 were for the important people, the VIPs, and these would never be cut off. Category 2 lines were somewhere in the middle. They would remain connected, working as normal, in all national emergencies except war. But Duncan Campbell's book offers a sinister addition to that. If you were just an ordinary Joe, and you lifted your handset after the siren to find that your phone was still working, that implied that your line had been left operational on purpose, because your home or premises had been secretly designated for civil defence or military use. And so that meant that you could soon expect a knock at the door. Another benefit, of course, in asking the Swedish population not to use the phone at this point is that it helps prevent the spread of rumours, panic and fake news. And of course, we know that the Swedes were very aware of this risk in the countdown to war, the spread of misinformation, fake news, propaganda. So by forbidding use of the phone, that cuts off one way for it to circulate. Page 12 is called, again, sorry for any mispronunciation, Motstandsanda, which means resistance spirit. Again, this is unique to Sweden. Well, at least by unique, I mean it's not appearing in British civil defence booklets, because we were not talking about the risk of the Ruskies invading. The booklets were about surviving the nuclear attack. And if the attack had been successful, if deterrence had failed, the Russians would hardly want to invade, as there would be perhaps nothing left. And as Mad Theory tells us, if they had attacked us with nuclear weapons, we would have retaliated. So, well, no Ruskies left either. Obviously, that's me simplifying it to its most basic, but if you've turned a country into a radioactive wasteland, you don't want to send your guys in, at least not for a while. So our leaflets were not concerned about resisting the Soviet invader. But we know that Sweden was anticipating a range of attacks. And yes, one scenario would be infiltration and invasion by the enemy. So as with Sweden's mention of a blackout, this again is more similar to Britain's Second World War civil defence activity, which had us unfurling barbed wire along the beaches to keep the Germans out, painting over road and railway signs to confuse any invader, and being aware of German propaganda broadcast in English on the radio. So the booklet warns Swedes to be wary of a barrage of false rumours and propaganda from the enemy via leaflets, rumours, political pressures and radio broadcasts. Quoting here from the booklet, the enemy will say that resistance is pointless, that it is better to give up. But remember, every message that resistance should be abandoned is false. We must resist, constantly and in all situations. The booklet very sensibly says that the best remedy for countering propaganda is knowledge and information. Learn which news sources you can trust. Now, I shudder, of course, to think how that might go these days, when I think so many people just blindly accept what they see on Facebook or Twitter. Or they'll all too lovingly adopt a slogan or a position just because it comes from a politician or a celebrity they admire. Or someone who has the right flags and symbols in their Twitter bio. So the booklet gives Swedes helpful tips to ensure that the news they're reading or hearing is truthful and legitimate. So turn to the newspaper that you know and trust. Check that it's not a counterfeit copy. Beware of any strange leaflets which might suddenly appear in town. And when it comes to radio, tune into a known and trusted Swedish station. But even then, if you're surfing the airwaves, you need to be aware that the voice of a known and trusted Swedish newsreader could be imitated by a foreign power. So be very careful of how you're tuning your radio. Are you definitely on the right station? This piece of advice is illustrated by a man in a suit, respectable and ordinary, speaking into the microphone. He's obviously the trusted newsreader. He's obviously the David Dimbleby or the Jeremy Paxman of Sweden. But behind him, looming over his shoulder and barking into another microphone, is a big, green, scowling, angular creature. The baddie spreading propaganda. Now, we're going to end this episode here because we are roughly halfway through the booklet, and looking at my script, we have reached 11 pages. Normally I get about half that for a normal episode. So we will finish the booklet in the next episode. And a reminder that the booklet is available on my Patreon page. So if you are a patron, you can log on to patreon.com/atomichobo and it is all there. And you can see the green scowling monster who's trying to imitate the voice of Jeremy Paxman. So thank you to my two patrons, Jason and David, who very kindly translated this booklet for me into English. I also want to thank my newest patrons. I know that I've been absent for the last month, so I wasn't expecting anyone new to sign up. I was expecting to lose quite a few patrons, but people have signed up and I'm very grateful to you. So let me thank Russian Blue, Imogen, Paul Motzuk, and thank you to Dave Owen for upgrading his membership. Dave, you now have access to all the bonus podcasts and I hope you're enjoying them. Oh, and we also have Jennifer Machino and Aidan McKeown and Sam. So thank you everyone for your support. And in our next episode, we will read the rest of the Swedish Civil Defence booklets. Thank you for listening.